The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org.
On January 16, 2008, the Korea Society hosted a panel discussion titled How and Why We Remember the Korean War. Far from being forgotten, the Korean War has been brought into renewed focus by the recent publication of The Coldest Winter, a reappraisal of the conflict by Pulitzer-winning author David Halberstam. Panelists Bruce Cummings, a professor of history at the University of Chicago, spoke about Halberstam's book, while Evans J.R. Revere, president of the Korea Society, spoke about the continuing impact of the war on inter-Korean politics. Panelists Thomas McGrath, Young Duck Kim, and George Drake, all veterans or witnesses in the conflict, shared their firsthand experiences of this turbulent era.
Good evening. Welcome to the Korea Society. I'm Evans Revere, the president of the Korea Society, and I am delighted that you're all here, and I want to issue you all, on behalf of all of us here at the Korea Society, a very warm welcome. Delighted to have you here in such great numbers. I don't know whether the turnout, which is just about wall-to-wall here this evening, suggests that there are a lot of pro-war folks in the audience, but I think there are a lot of folks who are interested in history, and that's what the topic is tonight. And so we're delighted to have you all here with us. We have a very, very special program, special in a number of senses here. It occurs to me in thinking about today's program that here we are some 54 years after the end of hostilities in the Korean War. And when you mention Korea to most people, the first thing that often pops into one's mind or pops out into the conversation is the Korean War 54 years after its conclusion. And that war, obviously, was one of the most significant military conflicts in American history and obviously in Korean Peninsula history as well. And that war, and in all of its scope, in all of its complexity, in all of its tragedy, in all of its heroism, when you think about it, was a profound experience for America and Americans and Koreans and Chinese and others as well. And all of those things are the subject of a very fascinating book by the late David Halberstam. That book turned out to be Mr. Halberstam's last work. It was a book that he had finished just shortly before a tragic accident that took his life. He had concluded his work on it, and it's a tremendous book. If you have not had an opportunity to read it, I commend it to you. And it's a work that struck me as particularly impressive because it seeks to document the war through the eyes of those who fought it and in the words, in many cases, of those who fought it as well. And it makes it all the better as a piece of firsthand history. When we thought about doing a program on the Korean War a few months back, we were motivated by a couple of things. And one of those things was, of course, the book and the fact that it was a book that was garnering quite a few favorable reviews, lots of popularity. And so we wanted to do something to commemorate the book and, of course, its author, the author of so many other fantastic books over the years, including about some other wars that America has fought in. But beyond that, we wanted to remind people that for all of the current efforts that have been going on for years to try to bring peace to the Korean Peninsula, including the six-party talks and bilateral talks between the United States and North Korea, North-South dialogue, all of these various efforts that are in play trying to bring peace and reconciliation to what has been a very troubled peninsula, the fact is that the shadow of the Korean War continues to hang over all of that work, continues to hang over the Korean Peninsula, and continues to affect things in profound ways. And we wanted to remind people of that by this program this evening. And today's program is one about memory. It's about how we remember that conflict and the horror of the conflict, the heroism, the barbarism, the tragedy, the triumph, all of those things and more. And it's how we remember the aftermath of that war. And that aftermath, as I suggested, is still with us in many respects today. And looking back, my own earliest memory of that war was as a young man watching war movies growing up. And I was really struck by this particular subset of the genre of war movies, looking at Korean War films that were made in the United States, because they were remarkably different in an odd and sometimes off-putting way from war films that Americans had done about virtually every other conflict that we had ever participated in. When you think about the themes of these films, the themes were odd and off-putting in many interesting ways. There were themes such as betrayal and brainwashing and collaboration with the enemy and failed leadership and ethnic strife in the ranks and civilian casualties, etc. These and other themes that were hardly typical of a genre that usually, at least in the American tradition, focused on battles and heroism, etc. And that notion of a genre of film about a particular war in American history that bore little resemblance to the films that I'd seen about other wars, that notion has stayed with me for many years since. And over the years, the memories of that war and what it must have been like have come rushing back to me frequently during my various travels in and around Korea. And they came back to me as I was just talking with a couple of my fellow presenters here. A couple of decades ago, actually more than a couple of decades ago, about 26 or 27 years ago now, when as a young diplomat, I was standing on the banks of the Yalu River on the Chinese side, looking across into North Korea and gazing into the stark area of North Korea that you can see when you look across from the Chinese border there. And I was there as the first American diplomat who was allowed to visit that area. And it also struck me on my return trip from visiting that area that I was actually the first official American, the first representative of the United States government who'd stood on the banks of the Yalu River since that cold, late November day in 1950 when the soldiers of the 7th Division had reached an area just upstream from where I was in a place called Haesanjin. And those memories also came rushing back on a cold January day about a decade ago when I was standing on a frozen hillside in Kujang County in North Korea. And I was standing there next to a KPA, North Korean Army colonel, and we were walking through what had been a battlefield in October and November of 1950. And it was a battlefield in which a large force of Chinese People's Volunteers, as they call themselves, had overwhelmed and wiped out an American unit, a much smaller American unit, from the 24th Infantry Regiment. And we were walking through the battlefield, and the fighting positions were still there almost half a century later. You could still see where soldiers had fought as we walked through this battlefield. And the irony of my presence there was here I was an American diplomat accompanying a group of people from the United States Congress, and we were walking the battlefield with our former enemies, the KPA, and the purpose of our walkthrough was that we were working together, Americans and North Koreans, working on recovering the remains of American soldiers who had died on that battlefield half a century before. It was a very emotional moment for all of us. This evening is going to be an opportunity to talk about lots of memories. I've talked about a few of mine. And we have assembled a really superb group of people with whom to do that. And starting off this evening will be a noted scholar, a noted author, one of the leading experts on the Korean Peninsula in the United States, Dr. Bruce Cummings. He's a professor of history at the University of Chicago. He's a noted author. including one of the seminal works on the Korean War, a book called The Origins of the Korean War, and he's written much more than that over the years. And his writing and research has focused on other areas as well, including modern Korean history, East Asian political economy, and many other areas. And he will lead off this evening with some comments about Dr. Halberstam's book and the war and this issue of memory. And then after that, we're going to have a conversation. Myself and Dr. Cummings will be joined by three veterans of that period to have a conversation about memory and the war. And participating in that conversation will be Mr. Thomas McGrath, who was in the U.S. Army during the Korean War. He served with the 10th Field Artillery Battalion in 1953-54, and then following the war went on to a distinguished career as an attorney. We are also joined by a good friend of the Korea Society and a good friend of mine, Mr. Yongduk Kim, who grew up in Korea, experienced the war as a young civilian, and was there when the war broke out. And following the war, he joined Hyundai Group and went on to a very distinguished career, ultimately becoming president and CEO of Hyundai Corporation. And he's been a very good friend and close colleague of mine for quite some time. And we also have a gentleman I met only yesterday, and we struck up a wonderful relationship, and we found out we had a lot in common by virtue of our common military service in Korea and a number of friends that we have in common who also served there, George F. Drake, who is joining us this evening. He served with the U.S. Army Security Agency in Korea during 52-53. Later, he went on to become a professor of sociology. He's a man of many talents and many languages, some of which we share in common. And so if you see us chatting with each other in Korean, Chinese, or some other odd tongues from Northeast Asia, please forgive us. But it's a wonderful lineup, and I think you're going to enjoy this immensely. But without further ado, I would like you to please to join me in welcoming, to lead off our program, Dr. Bruce Cummings.
Well, thank you very much. It's wonderful to see such a large gathering here. I also want to myself to thank the Korea Society, Fred Carrier, Patrick Clare, Evans, for bringing me in from Chicago. I thought I might not make it. I've landed at Islip Airport on Long Island just because of my schedule today at Chicago, but it was very easy, to my amazement, coming in on the Long Island Expressway. We in our family have a couple of teenage boys, one of them in college, and every once in a while we have family discussions about important things like the seven deadly sins, for example, that kind of thing. And one time the sin of envy came up, and my sons asked me if I envied anyone, and my first response was, no, not really. I don't really envy anyone. Well, come to think of it, I'd like to be Robert De Niro, I told them, and they thought that was pretty funny. But had I thought of it, I would have said David Halberstam, because he combines the kind of career that I have, writing history, with the kind of career I wish I had, playing professional sports or writing about them. David seemed to go back and forth from the best and the brightest to the Chicago Bulls and then to another serious book, and then, not to suggest that the sports books aren't serious, and then to a book on the Patriots or something like that. And when I told this to my sons, since they're also big sports fans, they agreed that I had missed my calling, but David certainly didn't. I met David twice, once when I invited him to the University of Chicago, and another time when he invited me to New York to talk about the Korean War. About 10 years ago, I used to chair a committee at Chicago that invited famous people to campus, and I indulged myself by inviting people I wanted to meet, like Arthur Ashe, Bill White, Marcelo Fools, Vincent Canby, the great critic, a late critic at the New York Times, and David Halberstam. I couldn't get all my choices. I actually went to the administrator in charge of this thing and said, can we get Kareem Abdul-Jabbar? And he said, what's interesting about him? And that was the last time I had respect for that particular administrator. A few years ago, David called and asked me if I could come to New York, or the next time I'd be in New York, could we talk? And he left a message on my phone, and I called him back, and to my amazement, his number is listed in the Manhattan phone book, and even more amazing, he answers his phone. David Halberstam here. I don't know anybody who is, even a college professor with a very low level of fame who does that anymore. So we talked about the Korean War. We had lunch. I met his lovely wife, Jean, and a very fine German Shepherd. His daughter's German Shepherd. We walked over to Central Park. It was about 3 in the afternoon, and he said, I can walk into Central Park with this dog at 3 in the morning, and no one comes anywhere near me. He was charming and gracious, engaging, and what I most remember is how vital he was in his early 70s. And then came the coldest April, last April, with this shocking and tragic accident, which also is just a completely capricious work of fate. I'm so sorry about that, and I'm particularly sorry that he couldn't be here tonight. We're talking about memory tonight, and at the end of the MASH TV series, which, as you all know, is set in Korea but is really about the Vietnam War, Hawkeye says that we drink to forget. For years, I would get even angry when people would call the Korean War the Forgotten War, and I would give them a little lecture about how it's not over. It's still going on. How can a war that's not over be forgotten, and so on. And about 20 years ago, in a documentary film that I was involved in with, we came up with the name The Unknown War, because at least in the United States, it's largely unknown. But now, long in the tooth as I am, I know that for Americans it's both. It is a never-known war and a forgotten war. Veterans of the Korean War are the ones who first gave it this name. From their hard experience of dealing with Americans, particularly younger ones, who didn't know much about the war, and above all didn't know how terrible it was. It was one of the most brutal and devastating wars of the 20th century. In some ways it may have been the most devastating when you look at civilian to military or soldier casualties, for example. It actually is worse than Poland in World War II, which is considered to be one of the very worst in terms of the slaughter of innocents. People don't know where to place the war. Several times students have asked me if I've fought in it. And I say to them, well, I know I look really old to you, but can you tell me what decade the Korean War was fought in? And they often can't. It happened actually only a few years, a decade, before our deepening involvement in Vietnam. It might as well have been a generation before, and in some ways it was. I mean, it was fought or led by our World War II generals like MacArthur and Ridgway and a whole bunch of others, Mark Clark. If you type Korean War into the Amazon website, you will come up with maybe 10 or 12 books that are still in print and a whole host of others that aren't or can be gotten from used bookstores. Browse a library, and you'll find rack after rack on the Vietnam War and maybe one rack on the Korean War. David Halberstam actually did that on a vacation in Key West, as he says in the book. He went into the public library, found 88 books on the Vietnam War and 4 on the Korean War. I think this has broad ramifications beyond our understanding of the wars we get into. We have still not been able to solve the problem of North Korea, which is essentially the reason we came to Korea in the first place in 1945. And the media treatment of North Korea and Kim Jong-il, its erstwhile leader, is mostly mimetic in the sense that one channel copies another. It's almost always ignorant. But what you can be sure of is this, that there will be very little, if any, link to the Korean War. And if there is a link, it will be a cliché. But in many ways, North Korea is the state formed by the Korean War. It's a garrison state. It has a million-man army. I can go on about this later. It is an amazingly, I think, by far the most militarized state on the face of the earth, and that's an outcome of the Korean War. Furthermore, for the North Koreans, the war is recent and palpable. You see posters about it when you're in North Korea. Last year, Diane Sawyer, the sort of morning anchor of ABC News, well, it was October 2006, She went to North Korea, and she interviewed the general who's responsible for the northern side of the DMZ. And she said, oh, well, that's a very weighty responsibility. How long have you been doing that? And he said, 40 years. In other words, back before the Tet Offensive, back before the Pueblo crisis, it's amazing. But for the North Koreans, there's a very continuous history of confronting the U.S. from their point of view, going back now 62 years. In my own research, I came to the conclusion that this is a terribly important war, even though it may be forgotten. And little things were interesting. For example, that Marilyn Monroe was discovered during the war and became the Betty Grable of the Korean War with her photo on the walls of tents and things like that. She was called Miss Flamethrower. Margaret Bourke White, the great photographer for Life and other magazines, took hundreds of photos, not just of the Korean War and the soldiers, but of the unknown guerrilla war that was behind the lines. And published her photos in Life magazine, but there are many more that weren't published. So I think it's to David's great credit that he did his last book on this war. Of course, we all know it wouldn't have been close to his last book because he turned a book out every 2 or 3 years, and he was so young and vital, as I said, that I'm sure there would have been other books to come. I think he deserves credit also for exploring the history that he lived through. When we talked, it was about, I mean, I was 6 years old when the war began, and he was a young man. And so he remembers vividly all the issues relating to the war, especially Truman's firing of MacArthur. I don't know any other writer who has so deeply explored the history that he lived through or was exposed to, especially in David's case, the early years of the Vietnam War. But whether it was in Saigon or in the ballpark, David was there. I think Philip Roth and Don DeLillo in fiction have done this, particularly with Don DeLillo's book Underground, which is really about the Cold War in its entirety, but how it affected things in a variety of places in the United States told through his characters. Let me first ask why it's a forgotten war. And then get to what I think are the real strengths of David's book. I have a long and a short answer to this question, but I don't have a good answer. The war was fought during the McCarthy period, and J. Edgar Hoover or Senator McCarthy or Senator Pat McCarran were ready to lock you up for dissenting. The New York Times had a front-page article a few weeks ago about CIA documents, the first one on July 9, 1950, within 2 weeks of the war beginning. Hoover asked Truman permission to lock up 12,000 people who he thought might be subversives. War coverage was and is, if you go back to the library, quite fascinating in the summer of 1950. You could sit in your barbershop and read harrowing tales of Americans fighting a lot of rearguard actions as the North Korean army moved down all the way to the Pusan perimeter. But then MacArthur's censorship descended, and what got out after that was much less interesting. But I think one of the larger reasons why this war is forgotten is that the Korean War, as a terrible and desperate struggle, kind of counterpoints the way that Americans like to remember the 1950s. I mean, Newt Gingrich once nominated 1955 as the high point of the American dream. I mean, I'm sure it was for him if he were black or person of color, it wasn't. The civil rights movement really changed this country so fundamentally in the 1960s, but certainly not in 1955. But amid this nostalgic reminiscence, you have to allow the Korean War to disappear because it doesn't fit the image of the halcyon 50s. It was also a war that seemed to be about Stalin and Truman, and what person outside of Stalin's coterie of supporters would not choose Truman if that were the issue. I think those soldiers who fought in the first 9 months of the war, which is really what David's book covers, he stops in the spring of 1951 in terms of a narrative and then leaps forward to a number of other issues, and then the book concludes. that is a war that raged back and forth across the Korean Peninsula, as you all know, and all kinds of innocents suffered in that. Millions and millions of people were displaced from their homes, particularly in North Korea, or wanted to get out. Excuse me. But after that, for the last 2 years, the war essentially became a kind of trench warfare like World War I along what is now the DMZ. I mean, that's how the DMZ was formed from 1951 to 53. In the last 2 years of the war, therefore, American soldiers didn't get to know Koreans except as servants or fellow soldiers or bar girls or something like that. They didn't have much contact with Korean society. Of course, in the first year, the kind of contact they had with Korean society was often a violent one. But that's another reason that this is a never-known war, because it did not bring Americans together with Koreans, really. Koreans were fighting, in many ways, a separate battle, except for those Koreans attached to the United States Army. And I think this fact opens up a chasm between Korean and American narratives of this war. Also a chasm between those who lived through the war and younger historians, between those who work in the many archives that are now open on this war and those who don't, or those who lived through it and think, you know, they have their particular truth about the war, which no archival document is necessarily going to shake. When I worked on this documentary, I dealt with a British general who was the primary military consultant. I was the primary historical consultant. And every once in a while, we would have a little tiff over an interpretation, and he would say something like, "My dear boy, I was there. Don't care what your documents say." And I mean, that's a profound tension between people who do history while those who experienced it are still alive, and the old kind of history where you never open up an archive unless it's 50 years old, and then you can say what you want because the people in it are mostly passed away. Anyway, I worked on this documentary. It was absolutely fascinating. But I worked on it in part because a man named Jeremy Kuehl helped to locate the project at Thames, and he had said things about The World at War, which I think is by far the best documentary series on World War II done by Thames, that really attracted me. I mean, he said historians say pretty outrageous things when it comes to the British or American general population. Historians know them. They've known them a long time, but the public doesn't. He thought The World at War was too controversial to be made in this country. And then he says, "We say the Russians could have beaten the Germans on their own, that the British didn't really win the Battle of Britain. These things are really quite offensive. Not to the professional historians who have known them for 30 years, but offensive to American executives and producers who simply would not wish to commit resources to this kind of series." Thames, by the way, was a commercial network, not a public television network. Kuehl went on to point out, however, that the series was an enormous success in this country, in the U.S., and he asked this question: why is it that in order to make serious programs, which ordinary U.S. audiences find attractive, Americans have to come to Britain? It's very curious. And that's essentially why we made this documentary in Britain. For good historians, this is always the case. There's a chasm between the known and the assumed, or the heterodox and the conventional, the seen and the unseen. Interpretations come from the weight of new and often secret or formerly secret evidence. I think archival historians don't necessarily establish truths that are for good for all time, but they cut out a lot of possibilities that other people think, or a lot of things that other people think happened that couldn't possibly have happened. Well, anyway, with that as a preface about the problems of history and memory on the Korean War, let me talk about the book. I was asked to put the book in the context of the literature on the Korean War, and I'll do that in a minute. But I think the great things about the book are, first, wonderful, beautifully written portraits of the major figures in the war: Dean Acheson, Harry Truman, George Kennan, Douglas MacArthur, and especially Pinky MacArthur, his mother. When I first went to the MacArthur archives, it was back in the old days when they more or less vetted the historians that could come in, and if they thought they were critical of MacArthur, they might have a hard time. I was too young for them to know anything about me. Anyway, he took me to lunch, and the whole lunch was a kind of psychodrama where he talked about MacArthur's relationship to his mother. Well, David's description of Pinky MacArthur is worth the price of the book. He rightly says that this was the age of Acheson, a figure who was Secretary of State, but much reviled in part because of McCarthy's attacks on him. And Acheson dominated the basic decisions that brought the U.S. into Korea. But he could be dominant because, as he said himself, he had a constituency of one, Harry Truman. He didn't need the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he didn't need the Congress, or even necessarily the American people, because he could walk into Harry Truman's office. And as he said, David doesn't quote this, but I saw one paper where he said, the Joint Chiefs would make their arguments, and the State Department would say this, and some senator would say that, and then they all walk out, and I'd tell the president the truth, and he would always accept it. But I think that's very much the relationship between Acheson and Truman. David's portrait of George Kennan, who was just about the only serious or important official to stand in the way of the American invasion of North Korea after the Incheon landing, is one of the best in the literature. He's very good on the deep splits in the Republican Party at the time about how the United States should relate to the rest of the world. And my earliest political memories are from 1952, when one of my cousins was on the beach in Ohio. The Republican convention was on. Taft was going up against Eisenhower. Taft lost, and he just pounded his fist into the sand and was disconsolate that Taft had lost to Eisenhower. Taft represented small business, Midwestern isolationists who didn't necessarily want to be isolationists in the post-war world but did not want to have the kind of defense budgets we've had ever since the Korean War. One thing that David doesn't quite say, but he generally lays out the process, is that our defense budget was the very highest it has ever been in terms of constant dollars in 1952 and 53. It quadrupled during the Korean War. The Reagan buildup never got that high. We're at the Korean War level now if you add the Homeland Security budget, but if you take that out, we're still not at the Truman level. The Truman level was $55 billion, which would be about $670, $80 billion today. I mean, in my view, this is the great importance of the Korean War for the American people, that it was the war, kind of the fulcrum or the anvil, rather, upon which an enormous external set of bases, really an archipelago of military bases all around the world, and a national security state and an enormous defense budget, the anvil on which that was built. I mean, it might have been a different war, but it happened to be Korea, and that changed this country forever. It wasn't World War II. There was a very rapid demobilization after World War II. Anyway, David is very good on the Republican Party's ambivalent response to that. After that, the Republican Party never had an ambivalent response when it came to defense budgets. I mean, they have a big hole in their theory of the minimal state because they essentially always want bigger defense budgets. But they weren't like that before 1952. He catches Douglas MacArthur very well, maybe a bit too perfectly, in the sense that I believe he overestimates MacArthur's influence. But MacArthur is such an amazing figure. I mean, when you go into his papers or look at his odd intelligence chief named Willoughby, who was born in Germany. MacArthur called him my little fascist, and he might actually have been his little fascist. That stuff is just so rich. I mean, I was laughing out loud when I was reading through the Willoughby papers years ago, but I would assert that apart from Incheon, which was MacArthur's decision but had been prefigured in previous planning, which most people don't realize, and his fateful decision to split his army corps as he went into two columns as he went into North Korea, MacArthur made no decision that was central to the war. He is not responsible for going into North Korea. That was a decision that Truman and Acheson made at the end of August without consulting MacArthur. He liked the idea, of course, but it wasn't his. I think another strength of this book, in addition to all these portraits of of people who, as Acheson said, were present at the creation of the American post-war position in the world, the book will be really interesting to American veterans, or is interesting to those here tonight, because David interviewed a lot of them, and he tells many, many stories, and he tells them in a dramatic way. A fellow named Pappy Miller, who was an infantry soldier in World War II, he told David, in World War II, everything was done right, and in Korea, everything was done wrong. Ben Boyd, who was up near Unsan in October 1950, for Koreans, and actually for Americans, Unsan is a very important place because it was the site of the major American gold mine concession that was gotten out of King Kojong at the end of the 19th century and then lasted until the Japanese bought it out just before Pearl Harbor. And there was 50,000 Koreans working in this gold mine complex. And that's where the Chinese hid, and they came out in the third week of October and hit the American forces very hard and then withdrew for a while. I mean, it was obviously trying to send a message, you know, don't do what you're doing, don't go any farther, which we, our leaders, did not take. But Ben Boyd heard the strange bugles and noises and flutes and everything that the Chinese would use to disorient American troops before attacks and got attacked. And for 2 weeks, he was fleeing in front of onrushing Chinese forces. He was badly burned. He would walk at night and hide in the daytime. A kind Korean farmer fed him. Sam Mace is in two or three passages. He grew up poor in West Virginia, a World War II tank man. He said he was ambushed three times in his life. The first one was the Battle of the Bulge. And then he got ambushed twice in Korea when the Chinese ambushed him. He was fighting constantly for 2 nights without a wink of sleep, 2 days and 2 nights, until he escaped. Lieutenant Gene Takahashi, who was a Nisei Japanese-American, who was also up there fighting against the Chinese in the coldest winter and taken prisoner. David mentions a venerable Chicago reporter named Kais Beach, who has now passed away, but he was a foreign correspondent for the Chicago Daily News for a long time. Not the Tribune. He said the Tribune would never have me, but the Daily News. He was up there in the Changjin Reservoir. Americans called it the Choshin Reservoir, which is a Japanese pronunciation, but anyway. and he said Marines who fought at Iwo Jima were down on their knees begging for their mother because of the 40-degree weather, that is 40 degrees below zero, howling winds, ice, snow, mountains all around. People would get very disoriented, and that's why the Chinese used the kind of bugles and flutes and things that they did. When there's a lot of blowing snow, it's cold as hell, mountains all around. It's very easy to disrupt troops. Anyway, I was asked to put David's book in context in the literature on the Korean War. And here I'm going to be a little critical, not so much of David, but of the American literature on the Korean War, because it fits right in. It is another volume in the genre of what do Americans say when they write about the Korean War. David is mainly interested in narrating his Korean War, or the Korean War that veterans tell him about, rather than the one that historians have written about. We have just tons of formerly secret material that started coming out in the 70s and has been coming out ever since, both from the American archives, the Soviet, the Chinese archives, and the North Korean archives. Not that Kim Jong-il has opened up the archives, but MacArthur didn't come back empty-handed from the Yalu. He came back with thousands of boxes of captured North Korean materials, internal secret ones and published ones, and those were declassified in the archives in 1977. I read through them for 2 years until I had to get bifocals. Several of my students and friends have used that archive to write really original work on North Korea because we finally have something that isn't a pack of lies, something you can actually know whether, you know, it's true or not. David, right at the beginning of the book, he says that the best book on the Korean War in this country written by an American is Joseph Gulden's book. And Joseph Goulden is a journalist and an old friend of his. But his book came out in, I think, 1979 or 80, just as all the documents were coming out. And so that book is completely bereft of the new findings that really dozens, if not hundreds, of historians have found. I don't mean, again, to be critical. Journalists work as they do. But the fact is there are a lot of things that we know that we didn't know before 1980. I also don't want to say that one profession is better than the other, but rather that they're different. Unless you work for months in a good archive, you don't realize the difference between memory narrated decades after the fact by well-meaning individuals who have their things they want to say, or the memoirs of officials who served in Korea, newspapers and the like, and the doing of history. We go to the archives for the same reason that Willie Sutton robbed banks. He went to the banks because that's where the money is. We go to the archives because that's where the information is. The information is always better, I would say. I mean, people don't realize that all the newspapers that are published are also clipped and put into, say, an embassy archive, often with a commentary by an embassy person. So even the newspapers are better in the archives than they are outside of the archives. So what I'm trying to say without sounding arrogant is that there are lots of things historians know that other people don't. Otherwise, what's the point of our profession? I remember there's in the line of fire, Clint Eastwood is trying to romance a rather young, much younger woman on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And he says, the three pigeons down there, and he says the one on the left is going to fly away first. And the pigeon flies away first, and the woman turns to him and says, "How'd you know that?" And he says, I know a lot of things. But to put it in terms that David, if he were here, and I hope, would say or would agree, it's the difference between a serious sports fan and everyone else. If you're talking baseball and somebody says Ted Williams batting 406 in 1941 isn't such a big deal, you don't necessarily want to talk to that person anymore because he doesn't know anything about baseball. No one has batted over 400 since 1941. So there are many examples in David's book, and we had a very cordial engagement, but at the end I thought not necessarily a meeting of the minds. I would try to gently say, no, that didn't happen, and he would say, well, I think it did, and I would say, no, that didn't happen. I can't get into all of it, but for example, he starts off his book saying Acheson made a colossal blunder at the press club in 1949 by giving a green light to Kim Il-sung. Elsewhere, when he does his portrait of Acheson, Acheson is the central architect of the war, and not just that, but the entire American position in the post-war world, which is largely true. A man with a ruthlessly logical mind, how does he do blunders? And the answer is he didn't. I mean, I can talk about that in the discussion if you want to, but Acheson's press club speech is a very professional job of trying to keep about five different important people off balance. Kim Il-sung was one of them, but Syngman Rhee was another. Chiang Kai-shek was a third. He could not commit himself to defend these folks when they might not be able to defend themselves. Chiang Kai-shek had just contrived to lose the mainland of China, and Harry Truman wasn't going to commit to Chiang Kai-shek. Dean Acheson was not going to commit to Syngman Rhee. And when you look at the secret stuff, you find out the reason the South Korean Army didn't have tanks is because Acheson, not the military people, but Acheson said, no, we do not want them to have offensive weapons because they might use them against the North. So these are things that I think historians agree on because the documents are so clear. It's very hard to get what is an icon of that period out of people's heads, that Acheson made a big blunder and gave a green light to Kim Il-sung. Actually, even the Republicans didn't charge that. The speech was in January. The war began in June. There was hardly any criticism of the speech until after the war began, and then McCarthy got on the Senate floor and blamed Acheson for giving a green light to Kim Il-sung. So there are a number of other things like that. But I'm not here to be critical of David's book. It would be amazing if David were to manage all or even most of what is a truly complex history, a history that now really requires years of study before you put pen to paper. Another criticism, and it's a particularly relevant one tonight, I think, because we have so many Koreans and Korean Americans here, By the way, I'm a Korean-American, too. I signed the 2000 census Korean-American. My wife's Korean-American. My kids are Korean-American. Can't I be a Korean-American, too? So, anyway, Koreans really disappear from David's account, but they disappear from the entire American genre that David writes in. There are two Koreans that are given more than a few sentences, and that is President Lee Seung-man, Syngman Rhee, and General Baek Sun-yup. And those in the room who actually know about General Baek Sun-yup would find it amazing that he would be, you know, you might interview him for one reason or another, but you don't make him the fount of authority on the Korean War, in part because he has always been such a partisan, but also there are many things that we know about Baek Sun-yup that he would rather that you don't know. But those are the only two, really, the only two. He doesn't mention, except maybe in passing, that we occupied Korea in 1945, set up a military government. It was every bit as influential in Korea as our occupation of Japan or Germany, and that lasted 3 years. That was terribly important in the run-up to the war. It gets no mention. And that also fits the American literature because most people in this country assume that the war began like a lightning bolt on June 25th, and if you ask them what happened before, they don't really know, and they don't think it's important either. But wars don't just happen one day because an evil dictator decides to attack. There was a long, dilated origin going back into the 1930s and even 1920s. But I think this conventional American narrative, which David follows, although with a skill and verve and interest that hardly any of the other books on the Korean War have, I think it isn't David's problem or the other book's problem. It's a deeply American problem. We are a provincial country when we compare ourselves to Western European countries. I thought I had to learn Korean to study the Korean War. And I once, more than once, have said to people, what would you think of a foreigner coming to this country to study our Civil War and couldn't read English? I mean, this was a Korean War, first and foremost. It wasn't an American war or a Chinese war. It was a Korean war. In the past decade, I've run three job searches trying to find a person who is both skilled in international or diplomatic history and knows a Southeast Asian language. It could be Vietnamese or Indonesian or whatever. Well, about 10 years ago, we found Mark Bradley, who was a fine young scholar who did a book using some of the archives from Vietnam. Then Mark, for personal reasons, had to go to another university. We searched again, couldn't find a single person. Hired a person on the Middle East who knew Arabic. He left, and luckily Mark Bradley just last year came back. Another former student of mine just got a job at Princeton. He is one of the only people doing international stuff that knows Indonesian. This would be an absurdity in Europe, where scholars who work on Korea all know Korean, or they're not considered scholars of Korea. So, it's something that I see all the time. Europeans speak several languages, and we don't. And often Americans don't even see the point of what I'm talking about. But that's why we find it so easy to go to war in Korea or Vietnam or Iraq, and then find it so awfully hard to ever get out again. So we barge into civilizations that we don't understand, and we take actions. And before you know it, we're in a civil war or some other kind of conflict. In the case of Vietnam, we lost after 15 years of prosecuting that war. But we don't seem to learn from it. Ultimately, we don't know what we're doing in these countries, and therefore it would behoove us not to get into wars in these countries. The last thing I want to say about this is that I don't think it's possible to write about the Korean War if you want to be serious anymore without knowing Korean, because there's been, since Korea democratized, just an outpouring of literature in the South. Hundreds of books and articles, studies of the war, studies of the most terrible parts of the war, like massacres by the South Korean government or the police. These things are coming out by the ton. The government just finished a special report on the Cheju Rebellion that predated the Korean War, but is a terribly important event in the run-up to the war. As those interpretations slowly filter in to United States and Europe and China and Japan and so on, we will see a very a different Korean War, I think, than we see now. But I wouldn't have expected David, who, after all, is a person who doesn't sit for 20 years in an archive but wants to write a good book, something that he was interested in during his life, and go on to the next book, and write a book that Americans can understand and that isn't 1,500 pages long like my book. And so I say that's just fine. I wanted tonight to say what I would have said if David were sitting right here, and I'm just terribly sorry that I won't be able to get his reaction because of a quixotic fate, but I would have loved to hear what he would say in response. So thank you very much. You've been a very attentive audience.
Let me just thank Dr. Bruce Cummings for a superb presentation. And as an amateur historian myself, who spent a little bit of time in the archives, I sympathize with his view and also commend him for making the point about the importance of getting into these archives. Because, for example, one of my subspecialties, if you will, has been Chinese-North Korean relations, and some of the archival material that's come out, especially from the former Soviet Union archives, has really given us some amazing insights into the relationship between Beijing and Pyongyang during the Korean War and afterwards. And it really has debunked a number of the myths about this relationship that was supposedly as close as lips and teeth. But in any event, that's a subject perhaps of another another meeting. I thought I would start by asking what I think is a pretty obvious question of all of our participants this evening, and that is three of the gentlemen on the dais tonight lived through, in every sense of the word, the experiences that we have been talking about this evening. And I wanted to begin right at the top by asking them to share with us briefly, since we don't have that much time, their most vivid memory of their experience as a soldier or a civilian in the Korean War. And we are talking about war and military action and all that, but I wanted to begin building on a point that Bruce made during his presentation about the civilian aspect of this war, the civilian role in this conflict, by perhaps beginning with Y.D. Kim, who was growing up during this period and lived through it as a civilian rather than as a uniformed combatant. And share with us, please, if you would, looking back in this period, the thing that just leaps out of your memory from the Korean War.
Thank you, Vince. I was 17 years old, 1950, when the war broke out. I was in Suncheon. Professor Cummings just talked about Jeju revolt. And apparently, when our family moved down there, I think end of 48, beginning of 49, government wanted to send the regiment through Yeosu to Jeju Island. Apparently, we had a Yeosu Balan Sakon,
right,
and we had a revolt. And that's the time my family moved down there, and my elder brother was one of the investigators of this. And I remember so many people died at that time, both military and civilian, and he was kind of saying every day that how many had listing up all the confessions of the civilians, because they had an amnesty program. So if you confess, they make a list. In Korean, we call it Podo Yeonmaeng. That's, if directly translated, like a report alliance. Mm-hmm. I don't know how the proper English name. But that means, I think, whoever confessed, that they would,
an alliance of people who confessed.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Made report to the government, really,
yeah,
is what it means.
Yeah. And so I remember that. Then I think war broke out. My brother was part of the transportation bureaucracy at that time. He was a part of railroad. We had a special railroad security guard unit all over the country, mm-hmm, because so often attacked by the guerrillas. And so what happened was after that, soon the guerrilla movement started intensified in Jirisan area and Suncheon. I was, when the rains, my mother had in a kitchen. We had usually outside, you know, the kitchen, had a pile of firewood so that I can get in there for the night, because I think they always come down, pick up young people, and by hundreds, you know, they rice or any ammunition or anything they can pick up. Then they go away, the military comes in, you know, they don't come, they move to Gwangju, then come back again. So that was going on almost for a good 8 months, I remember. Then by the time almost they were wiped out toward the end of, beginning of 1950, Korean War broke out. And I think my story really is very simple. I think within about less than 100 miles from Suncheon toward Jinju, Masan, they couldn't get in Masan, I think, but they get into Jinju and North Koreans. And within that, about 2 months period from, I think we left Suncheon with my family July, about July 20th, you know, war broke out
June 25,
so it's less than a month. But by that time, you know, two North Korean columns came down this way, and we heard that they're almost there, so we have to leave. My elder brother already, their whole team went to Busan, so we thought we have to go to Busan. And when we really set out toward the highway to Hadong and, you know, that road, thousands of refugees, you know, and among them many police were left, the military people who couldn't join their regiment. So we came, took about 2 days, we came to near Hadong, Seomjin River. Mm-hmm. And at that time, we had all the rumors when we left that this alliance people, you know, South Korean government retreating, they killed them. You know, we had all those rumors, but I never witnessed it. But I think by the time we reached the Seomjin River, we were passing at night. Oh, we just smelled horrible smells all over. And we noticed, I think, just many barleys just full of dead people. So that's my first witness. And then we arrived at Seomjin River. You know, that bridge, highway bridge was bombarded, because I think UN forces already knowing that North Koreans are approaching, they destroyed and moved. So we didn't know. 1,000 people came there and stuck to the Seomjin River. And there was a little ferry, and we went to cross, but there was information that North Koreans are already in there. And I think we decided, that's very interesting, some skirmish, you know, that the ferry boat came from the other side, and the two North Korean soldiers disguised as a civilian, and about 3 or 4 or 5 big trucks came, military, you know, South Korean army trucks came, because they didn't know already, you know, bridge was broke, and they were standing there watching us, and those three North Korean soldiers coming, and they had, South Korean flags, you know, but they wasn't fooled, so they start shoot, and it just become chaos, and many people just fled all over the place. But I think our family and a few others decided we'll go south of the river, near estuary, mm-hmm. and hopefully that we cross. So we managed under the gunpoint. One of the farmers didn't want to go, give us, you know, his ship, but under the gunpoint we should be able to cross, because I think one of the disguised policemen was with us. So we were able to cross. Then we went about a day or so to Gosung toward the Jinju. We met the front reconnaissance scout of the UN forces. So we thought we were saved. And there, We were given a little bit of canned food, etc. We had and we slept. We had a fully eaten and we had a good sleep. But I think we were woken up by the thunder, some noises, because suddenly, you know, big batteries going on and UM4G is just retreating as fast as they can. And we had lots of refugees stuck right in between again. But to make that really, I mean, I don't want to spend too much time, but the important thing is we couldn't move on to Jinju because North Korean army already followed the UN forces. So there's Sachon Strait. If you go south, if you cross that strait, there's Sachon, then you can take a boat to Busan. So that was what we were trying to do and went to south. Only two families, one came all the way from Seoul on foot. Last whole month, they came on foot. And with that family, we went to this small fishing village, Seopori. We met a young man from one of the college students from Busan who was trying to help us to find a ship, you know, little boat to bring us across. And we slept and got ready in the morning, early in the morning we went. My mother on the way had a sprained ankle. And she said, she's a good Christian, right? And she said, this is God telling me something. So I'm going to stay. And then asked me and my younger sister, I was 17, she was 15. She thought, if you guys stay here, it's dangerous. So we went on with the boat, with the other family, you know, crossed, it took about 4 or 5 hours with a small boat. Then suddenly realized, just I can't go on. So I talked with my sister, I'm going to go back. So I think that Mr. Kim, I remember the college student, thought we are crazy. But we came back, and he introduced us to Mr. Lee, who was very reasonably well-to-do family there. You know, it's about 400 or 500, you know, houses in that little village. And turned out next day, North Koreans came in, and I found out Mr. Lee is one of hardcore sympathizer, and he become a committee chair of the Seopori. And soon I found out that he and many people, particularly many women whose husband and sons were executed before our forces retreated again, Bodo Yeonmaeng Alliance, and they're just rounding up everybody.
Let me jump in. You've really depicted the chaos and the confusion and the betrayal of this period, and also the action that was going on behind the lines, not just in the front lines, extremely well. But I want to ask our two friends who were serving there at the time to just a quick word about things that really leap out at you today. And then let me start with you, Tom, if you could, when looking back in this period. When you look back, what's the thing that grabs you about that, your experience there?
Well, what resonates with me in the remarks that Mr. Cummins made is the fact that we were very isolated. I arrived in Busan by ferry in July of 1953. Hostilities were coming down. There was a sort of a ceasefire going on. And from that moment, we were basically instructed, dictated to, by our military, not to fraternize, not to speak to, not to acknowledge the existence of any Korean that we should come across. Well, that was pretty simple to do since we were, when we arrived in Busan, we ended up in what was like a sort of a concentration camp. It was a barbed wire facility. And those of us who had just gotten off the ferry were now in this prison. And from that prison, we were loaded onto cattle cars, box cars. The windows were covered with this chicken wire so that people couldn't throw things in the windows. And we just started moving. Never saw a Korean. We moved up north where the train kept going, and finally it came to the end of the tracks. We got off the train, but got into trucks. We kept going north. I did not see a Korean. We get up to a place called Churwon, where I joined the 10th Field Artillery Battalion. We had a walk a good distance after the truck. And there I met my first two Koreans who were basically working for those of us in my particular battery. A very, very pleasant, nice young man and an older man. But the relationship was very much, they've got a job to do, we have a job to do, and we're not going to have any connection whatsoever. Of course, we could not eat any of the food. It was prohibited. We were kept in very, very, very tight circumstances.
So much for building alliance relationships back then.
And, of course, I was in Churwon for over a year. I left twice to go to Japan, which is a peculiar excursion in of itself. But in that entire time, I never saw a building that was more than one story high. I saw nothing but devastation. There was no farming. There was no industry of any kind. It was like you were on the moon.
Well, one of the obvious reasons for that was the effectiveness of the field artillery, especially in the Churwon Valley, which was the reason that we were able to bring the Chinese efforts to push south to a halt. Yeah. Let me jump over to George and ask you just to make a quick comment about the thing that sort of leaps out to you as you reflect back over this period.
The children. When I started my research on the relationship between the GIs and the children of Korea during the war, I had a veteran come into my office, older than me, but he looked and acted old, except today I have a sore back, so I act older today, too. I'm 78. Hey, what are you doing? I said, I'm trying to study the relationship of the American servicemen and the children of Korea during the war. And he started crying. He just wept. He said, I have a Silver Star. I have Purple Hearts. I served in Korea, and I can accept my other GIs being killed behind me or next to me. That was part of our mission to fight. I can't accept what happened to the civilians, and especially to the children. He said those children didn't deserve it. He said, thank you, dried his eyes, it still reaches me. And he got up and left. When we trained to go overseas, you had to teach the American young man to hold a gun and shoot another human being, to charge at that sandbag screaming, kill! I went through that training. We didn't have to be taught to offer solace for a crying child, feed the hungry child, take the injured child to a medic, or find shelter for the homeless child. That came with being American. That came out of the values that we learned at home, in our communities, in our churches, in our schools, in our families. Call it family values, if you will. And the servicemen were deeply, deeply touched by the plight of the children. It was estimated there were 100,000 children on the streets. In my research, I've been able to state clearly, we saved the lives of over 10,000 children. We helped sustain over 54,000 and more than 400 orphanages built by the GIs and the servicemen who built or helped repair those institutions. In my company, when I got there, I wasn't ready for anything like this. Yeah, I'd had several years of, I'm crazy. When I was 18, I bought a bicycle and headed for South America. I spent years on the road in the jungles and the mountains and whatever of South America, living with the native peoples and such. I wasn't ready for what I saw in Korea. The company bulletin board had a notice, our company supports an orphanage. Anybody wants to help, come. I went over there. There's 55 children in this little bombed out shack that we put together, that the servicemen in my company put together. Every month we shook the pay can. We had 200, 220, 230, depend when a number of men in our company. In 1 year, we donated over $4,000 from a pay that was 50-some bucks a month to 60, 70 bucks a month, depending on your rank. Impressions? Houseboy, Georgie, come. Little girl caught in the barbed wire in our fence. She's been there for a day crying. They came to me because I ended up being very active with this orphanage. We got her to the hospital. I won't elaborate the story, but time and again, our servicemen would pick up these kids. A six-year-old girl with a two-year-old baby on her back, begging. No family. That's it. And the GIs just unloaded their hearts. They unloaded their pockets. They stole food from the mess room. They did everything they could to help those children. And they did a magnificent job. And what hurts me deeper than anything is that story never reached the newspapers. It never got anywhere. And I can still remember the first kid that I was able to pick up in my arms and carry, literally lifeless. And then in 2-3 weeks later, there's a smile. And they're glad to see you. And they run and they hug you. You know, there's something about saving the life of a child that you'll never forget.
Thank you very much for that, George. We've had a very interesting, please. We've had a historical perspective, a military perspective, a humanitarian perspective, a civilian perspective. I think we're off to a good start here. And knowing how limited our time is here, let me go ahead and open the floor to questions at this point. We don't have much time, so I really would ask that you very quickly identify yourself. Do ask a question, and if it's directed to any particular member of the panel here, please indicate who it's directed at, and then we'll ask our panelists to chime in the hat right there. Well, I guess we have two hats.
The hats have it.
The ladies first.
Hello, my name is Dorothy Young. I'm also Simpson Thatcher personnel. My question is addressed to Mr. McGrath. Can you think of any virtues of a war, any war? I ask this question because if you were given a choice, would you rather handle civil criminal cases involving person of Korean heritage or a Korean entity encompassing wide range of issues that are shameful, unspeakable, atrocious, egregious, unfair, racist, and conducts of that sort, or wage a war?
Well, there's no question but that war is the worst. There's very, very little justification, in my opinion, for a war. Do I believe in self-defense? Of course I do. Do I believe in capital punishment? No, I don't. But that doesn't mean that I wouldn't kill someone who was attacking my family. There are two different views here. The answer is, and I've devoted my life in the law, to finding solutions. I call myself a lawyer that's involved with dispute resolution. Avoid court if you can. Find a common ground. And then negotiate and bring parties together, because it can be done unless you're dealing with someone who is insane. You can negotiate and you can find common ground, and that's what I hope that answers your question.
Sounds like what I did for 30 years as a diplomat. Gentleman raising his hand right there.
Thank you. To many Koreans, particularly old ones, General MacArthur sits very high place in terms of honor and respect. And as I read over the book, and not only David Hoffman's, but the other books, you get the impression, particularly in this book, he just become monster. And he traced back to his mother and his father in Philippines and all this. Mm-hmm. Is there any individual or group or books who can defend General MacArthur somewhat different from what the book describes, General MacArthur. Yes, I'd like to ask the questions to Professor Cumming.
Well, it's a very important question because I think David is, I would think, not knowing him very well, a kind of New Deal liberal. That's the way he grew up. And the prosecutors of this war were all people who became liberal icons like Harry Truman and Dean Acheson. And the simplest thing for what turned into a horrible crisis for the United States, I mean, David is pretty good on this. I mean, when the Chinese came into the war and it was the middle of the winter in December 1950, Truman declared a national emergency. People thought World War III was at the doorstep. As Acheson says, quoted in this book later on, this destroyed the Truman administration. I mean, Harry Truman could run for president again if he wanted to, but he didn't. It's rather like Lyndon Johnson in 1968. Truman's 1952 Gallup poll numbers were as low as George Bush hit last summer. And those are the two lowest, except when Nixon resigned in 1974. So the war was very unpopular, and so was Truman. But later, through a very, very deft kind of ventriloquy, Acheson held seminars at Princeton with Kennan and a number of other people. They're fascinating to read. But if I would say, you know, what is the most important thing animating those seminars, it's to blame MacArthur for all the things that went wrong. And that then turned into Acheson's book on the Korean War. Richard Rovere and Arthur Schlesinger wrote a book on the general and the president that defended Harry Truman. What I consider to be the real facts that I mentioned earlier, that MacArthur hardly made an important decision during the entire war, were completely lost. It was Truman and Acheson and a bunch of other people, Dulles, who wanted to go north. Kennan was the only one who didn't. And MacArthur had no part of that decision. So there's a real tendency in the American literature to blame MacArthur because this war turned out rather badly, particularly if you happen to be a liberal Democrat. I'm not saying that this is any one-to-one relationship. It's just that David's natural inclination would be to find MacArthur a repellent person and to find Harry Truman and Dean Acheson, you know, people that he can really like and support. When I first went to Korea, Koreans told me, "Don't you think General MacArthur is a great hero?" And I would tell them, no, number one, and number two, that when I was 7 years old, I was coming home from school, and I saw Shriners marching up and down the street saying, "Up with MacArthur, down with Truman." And then somebody broke a window or something, and the cops showed up, and I was all scared. I ran home, and I asked my father what's going on. The people with these weird hats criticizing the president. He said, "It's just a bunch of right-wingers." But that was probably my first political memory that tore this country apart for a while, and then MacArthur kind of faded away. And the liberal verdict won. I mean, I'm one of the only people in this small field that has tried to say what I just got done saying and to prove it, that if you want to blame anybody, you know, MacArthur is about 10th in line, not first in line.
I'm trying to recall, however, about David's book, The Reckoning, where he, you know, he does not attack MacArthur.
That's right.
In fact, he says MacArthur was the man who really was able to pull Japan out of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and make it an industrialized power.
That's
so,
right.
So David did not constantly, was not always critical of MacArthur.
Yeah. That's absolutely true.
This gentleman right here.
Yes. My name is Mr. Kang. I'm a president of the Korean War Veterans Association of Great New York, which has 170 members. However, we lost four this year. Last year. And we associate with the American veterans, you know, the tri-state area. And I was 4th Iraq Division reconnaissance platoon. You know, I was in the front line 1950 through the 1951. When I get the shot, you know, I was wounded by the, you know, I have an eyes transplant, you know, thank God to, you know, America's technology, you know. you know, life and death, we are facing, brothers, could be my cousin, other side, youngster. We're facing each other. I lessened the loan, you know, the life. Dead in life is a piece of paper, sliced paper, you know. So if I get survive, I will be generous to the everybody, you know. So when I come back, I mean, still I am buying a soldier for the, my fellow soldiers, combat, you know. However, you know, it's not the forgotten war. We just cannot forget because I lost so many of my fellow veterans. We only survived the A out of the 32. So, you know, still, you know, we have to, you know, we have to, you know, not to the GI side, but the Korean side. We have 160 still life in the, you know, living in the New York area. And we tried to write some episode of the war, you know. We had.
Do you have a question for one of our panelists?
Well, we maybe, the our fellow American veterans, you know, maybe. We exchange a program, which is like, you know, I will, after the session, I will give you a name
excellent
card.
Idea. Thank, okay. Thank you. And thank you for your service and for being here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. This woman right here. Why don't you wait for the microphone there?
This is not a question. It's a comment. I went through the Korean War from the beginning to the end, and I hope next time you have any program on Korean War, I hope you will include one woman at least as a discussant. because I saw so many women in Korea who suffered greatly during the war, and the women's experiences were a little different from men's. Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree with you more.
I was tempted to bring my wife today, who was strafed and wounded by an American aircraft, but we'll save that for another time.
thanks for your comment. Really, I thought maybe I can give a little more broader perspective if I had the time. But I think biggest thing I in my memory that to that short period of time was. During the war, the people get so antagonistic to each other, and they just don't mind killing each other. I mean, I have seen that. I told you about when I left, when I was going to Hadong, I have seen that. I just couldn't finish my story there. They wrapped up, you know, all those people, because, you know, previously when they lived, they executed those people. Then they wrapped up maybe by 100, small village. They never came back, most of them. Then 2 months after, UN force came up. Mr. Lee and myself was jailed with another number of people. I was just waiting, counting the day, and my mother has to go all the way to Suncheon, took a week, find the church minister, come back, and save me because I think I helped. You know, I had to help. So I think that's just my memory in those short period. After that, I went on, of course, went to, you know, university, etc. Now I'm here. But what I have seen during the war, people can turn each other. I mean, this story maybe you heard, Mr. Cummings, about the small villages in many areas where back and forth and killing each other. And I have seen it.
Well,
remains in my mind.
Some of the legacy of that is still with us today.
I want to
take another question here because we want to make sure our audience has a chance to ask questions. And this gentleman right here in the front row.
My name is Song Wook Cho, and I'm working for the Korean Tourism Organization, which is the government tourism office based in Fort Lee, New Jersey. As everyone would agree today from this discussion, our number one mission would be stopping the war, which is legally still going on, and we have to make some kind of peace agreement between South and North. I think for that purpose, right now, Six Nation talk is going on, and I'd like to ask a question to Professor Cummings. What is your expectation about the result of Six Nations talk for stopping this war and for establishing new peace agreement between South and North Korea, and also in relation to the start of the new government in Korea. Thank you.
Well, I think the one of the simplest things that the six-party talks could solve would be getting a peace agreement to end the Korean War, not only because the North Koreans have wanted that for more than 10 years and have given up the idea of a peace treaty with the U.S., which would never get through the Senate, but because there were four-party talks back in the mid-90s under the Clinton and Kim Dae-jung or Kim Il-sung administration, or both. And there were quite a few meetings, and I was told around 1997 that things were coming very close to getting a peace agreement for the Korean War. So I think they can, as Evans would know, I mean, you can dust off that diplomatic documents and get that done pretty well. Unfortunately, the nuclear problem has to be solved first from the standpoint of the United States and I think the new South Korean government. But I do think if we can solve the nuclear problem, then a peace agreement would come very quickly.
I was a participant in those four-party talks, and we didn't quite get as far as some have suggested, but at least we got them off to a start. I think we have time for one more question, and then I'm going to encourage folks afterwards to mingle and stay a bit and talk a little bit more. And this gentleman right here has had his hand up for a while. If you could please make the question very brief.
Question. We asked, at 19 years old, South Korean soldiers in 1950. Why are we here in Pohang? I was in the division headquarters. And one night, at 2 a.m. in the morning, we received a report. Our column is collapsing. And I knew there was one friend of mine who said the day before, why are we here? He was a senior at the Seoul National University, my university. I was a freshman, 19. I don't think we have answered the whole question. Bruce, you are absolutely right. Mr. Halberstam does not relate to Koreans. Even the preface. The prejudicial remark about Korean landscape. You know how lovely Korean landscape, the mountains after mountains. Sure, if you are artillery soldiers, you want to move on the flat land. I'm sorry, forgive me. I owe to my comrade who died to tell you. I don't think we have answered. Bruce, Yongdok Kim, my cousin, and Mr. McGrath, let us study more. Sir, in Pohang, I survived only because United Navy vessels provided artillery support. Kim Woo-jung was North Korean artillery leader. Kim Seok-won was my division leader. Kim Seok-won knew how good artillery man Kim Woo-jung was. And I still don't know whether I'm still alive. And I think President Rivera, let's have another session. Why? We don't know.
I just want to say Professor Kim is an old friend of mine. He teaches at the CUNY Graduate School and is an expert on Hegel, among other things. So he's not just a Korean War veteran.
I wanted to add one thing, if I might, in answer to the question that was raised about how to bring this together. Among other things, I'm also a member of the board of directors of the New York Philharmonic. And as you've probably been reading in the papers, we're going to take that orchestra to North Korea and perform. The big issue right now is finding a hall that our music director is happy with.
It's done.
But
I help them find it.
But the point is that this is the way you start to bring cultures back together and to the table. It's through this type of an effort. Now, the Philharmonic, by the way, is being criticized widely. I hate to use words like right-wing or neocon, but they're being criticized for taking that step. They feel it's a propaganda move on the part of the North Koreans. And, you know, it may well be, but it doesn't make any difference. The point is we should go, we should perform, and we should be proud of the music that we're going to bring there. And I think that will pay off.
Just one note in that regard. We are very proud at the Korea Society who have been to have played a helpful role in negotiating the New York Philharmonic's trip to North Korea. We were the intermediary between the Philharmonic and the North Koreans and spent a lot of time trying to make this marriage happen. And on the 26th of February in downtown Pyongyang, among other things, the New York Philharmonic is going to play the United States National Anthem in downtown Pyongyang. The first time I believe that's ever happened in North Korea.
Can I make a last remark?
One last comment.
Number one, make a note. If you want more information on the relationship of the GIs to the kids, I wrote a little booklet called GIs and the Kids, A Love Story, American Servicemen and the Children of Korea, 1950 to 54. That material is found on the website called koreanchildren.org, 1,500 pages of stories of how GIs went out of their way to save the lives of these children. Take a look at that. The stories are there. And the point, I guess, is that we keep hearing about the forgotten war. You can't forget what you never knew. And the problem here was that we had a story here about this child being rescued, this child over here and there, and no one ever put the pieces together until I went to the archives, National Archives, the newspaper archives of the Stars and Stripes in that same old building in Tokyo. I spent 8 days scanning everything I could find, including the stuff on the floor. I mean, their archives were in horrible condition. But what comes out is a story of love and compassion that exceeds the imagination. It blew me away. Every unit literally was adopting orphans or orphanages, and the GIs donated over $2 million out of their salary. We called to send letters home asking for help. You know what the Americans did? They sent thousands and thousands, not of packages, but tons of packages. The Army had to lease an additional ship once in a while to get that material over there. The servicemen could not see what was happening there and not participate. And the women, somebody has to take that one on. Husband's gone, you're used goods. Who's gonna help those women? They're a throwaway, and that aspect of the war also totally ignored in the American literature. I don't know what's in the Korean.
But Heidi, last word.
Yeah, I think just closing. You know, I from my memory of this war experience, how tragic this war can be. You know, if you go back now, people so lovely Korean people. I visited. That's Seopori, as a matter of fact. It's a beautiful little village. You never know what happened, you know, so many years ago. I think just looking at the Iraqi war now going on, you know, we all are very concerned. The civilian side of the tragedy, you know, when the war goes on, civilian side among themselves, antagonizing, killing each other, so many, you know, unfortunate tragedies are happening. I think that's, I just wanted to ask you to think of it. You know, when the Korean War was exactly the same as the Professor Cummings said, it's one of the most brutal war ever happened in the human history. Thank you.
This has been a most interesting discussion, and without question, we've only just scratched the surface. We will be doing more on this topic in the future. We wanted to start off with this discussion of memory, though, to sort of set the stage for what I think will be an ongoing set of programs, I hope, to talk in more depth about all of these issues and more, including the role of women and the humanitarian aspect of the conflict. It's been a fascinating evening. Thanks to our wonderful panelists here, and thanks to all of you. There are some photographs in the back that I think many of you may be familiar with, but if you're not, they're part of a traveling collection of photographs that the Korea Society has put together, and I encourage you to have a look at them because they really are some incredibly striking images of this period. If you like the sort of thing that we've done tonight, come back for more. It's going to be a fascinating year of programs for us, not just about the war, but a number of other hopefully more pleasant topics as well. But we will do more on this subject. And I think the handout that you got indicated that there is a film that's being presented, and you can get more information about that on your way out. Please, as we bring the evening to a close, I want to thank you for being here this evening. Thank you for the good questions and comments. And most of all, if you would join me, please, in thanking our panelists. Good. Good. Excellent. Thank you. It was excellent. Well done. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Journal. Membership may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.